can change the trajectory that we're on. That's a fact. That isn't an opinion or an optimistic view. It is a cold, hard fact. What we need is that political will, and what we need is that we need that conviction for everybody to stand up and demand it right here, right now. And I think it's coming, and I think it's going to happen. And as an individual, this show is just my way of helping, trying to foster that.
Mm-hmm. Another question I had was, you know, that when we went through each section of this exhibition, you kind of named every single section as having its own muse. And, you know, working with scientific researchers, I'd imagine as much as you initially weren't as familiar with, like, their scientific process, they probably also weren't familiar at all with how exhibitions or art galleries work. How did they feel about being, like, direct inspirations for how this exhibition was put together?
That is such a great question. They're all such modest people, so they've all been kind of, I think, really curious to see this portrayal. But like you said, we come from different worlds, and, you know, an analytical brain is often firing different thoughts and different ways of seeing than a creative brain. So to me, and to many of them, it's a really beautiful partnership. It really kind of enhances the ability to tell a story and to communicate, I think, in a fuller, richer way. But I think I haven't had the opportunity for them to actually see their work yet. And I'm really looking forward to that moment, to actually just looking into their eyes and just seeing how they receive what my contemporary translation of them as a researcher is. And I think just from the conversations that I've had, even just from doing the field work, they're really excited about it. You know, most of scientific findings is communicated through papers circulated amongst academic institutions and in those communities. And it almost, you know, compared to, like, the public audiences, it's almost like an esoteric language. And so I think they're really excited to see how art can kind of bridge that, and how engagement can be fostered through different means than intellect, I guess.
In saying that, the last question I had, it might be a bit of a loaded one, but for those who do attend this exhibition, is there a central takeaway that you hope audiences have when looking at this as a whole?
Yeah. Well, there's a few. I hope people take the time to just experience the work for themselves. I hope that people have the opportunity to watch some of the interviews and have the opportunity to form a sense of trust with the people who are sharing this really important information of this moment with us, the experts that know these ecosystems, that know these dynamics, these feedbacks, these models, these forecasts, and have that time and space to discern for themselves, you know, what they resonate with and what they feel educated by. And then I hope that what this shows as an exhibition as a whole is an act of advocacy. So as an individual, I started getting involved in environmentalism before it ever permeated into my practice. And I realized early on, you know, I'm marching in climate rallies, I've, you know, became a vegetarian, I've lowered my carbon footprint, all these kinds of things. And I know that the notion is, it's like, oh, well, that's so much, but really, does it have an impact? And you know what? It does have an impact on your health, for sure. It's a positive, because anything I've ever done environmentally focused has actually benefited my health. But does it affect, you know, greenhouse gas emissions by large? Probably not. But it has affected my mental health. It has affected me feeling positive and feeling accountable to the future. But I realized that the loudest voice that I would have as an individual is through my creative practice. So what this show is an individual citizen who is just trying to use the unique skill set they have to communicate something really important to their heart. We all have the capacity to do this. We all have unique skill sets. We all have passion that we carry in our heart, and we have a voice that we need to use for those who don't have one. That's what I hope the takeaway is. Whatever it is, whatever calls you to your heart and soul, and whatever you have as your unique talents, your gifts, your place in this world, we need everybody in this moment to stand up, and we need everybody to voice, and we need everybody to advocate for the future that we want.
Once again, that was our conversation with Desiree Patterson, the exhibiting artist for Interglacial at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford. The opening of the exhibition was on July 11th, but this exhibition will be on until March 20th, 2027 at the Reach Gallery Museum. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfperg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
If you want to respond to anything you hear on Speak Up, or anywhere else you hear it on CJSF radio, you're welcome to give us a call here in the studio or send us a text message with your comments. You can do that at 778-782-2573. That's 778-782-2573, CJSF. We'd love to get your comments. We'd love to hear from our audiences and what you're thinking about the stories we're doing. So please give us a shout. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be back to talk about the Odyssey. But first, we have Gardening with Embark. All right, it's time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio here, as he does every week, is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability and our gardens expert. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Good morning, everyone.
So we're into week 29.
Correct. Week 29 is passing very fast. week 26, elementary, secondary schools went into summer break.
Yeah.
And we are in week 29. Going very fast. At this time of the year, we gardeners consider this as a midsummer. The midsummer, because it's 21 June. June the 21st was the solstice, so
yeah,
we are already almost a month away from that.
Yeah.
So yeah, we are midsummer. At this time, we gardeners, in particular in our garden, we see plants that are getting old.
Yeah.
And therefore being a nice environment for aphids.
So they've sort of grown what they're going to grow and matured as much as they're going to usefully.
Usefully, yes. So they have matured, and then, yeah. So we have some plants that went into flower, like the su choy, pak choy, spinach, and the other ones, the kale, that is a biennial plant. At the moment is attacked by aphids.
Right.
So it's completely covered with aphids. So at the moment is there's nothing to do with that. It's just remove the plant completely.
Yeah.
And then we have other crops like the peas. They are nice little small pods.
Yeah.
But the leaves are starting to be covered with white powdery mildew. So again, there's nothing else.
Now, do those things happen because the plant is sort of matured? Is it something related to their life cycle?
Yeah, it's related to the life cycle. Plants are maturing, therefore they are getting weak.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the leaves are drying up from the bottom towards the tip of the plant. And although we here water the soil, so we tend to avoid watering the leaves itself.
Yeah.
So the plant presented the diseases. So, it's time that the plant is telling us, I'm done. And since we use an intensive gardening method called square foot gardening, so once the plant, we see the plant is done, we just remove it, add a bit of compost, mix, and a new crop comes in. Yeah.
Right. And that's important to keep those pests from spreading to your other plants.
Yes. Yeah. They come. You don't bring them, they just show up, and we want to prevent that they they spread more. What we do is just trim at the bottom of the plant, and carefully we move that into a designated compost for plants with infested plants and plants with diseases, plants with seeds and wheat. Everything goes in one different container. We don't add this to the compost.
Yeah,
we don't tend to add this to the compost because the aphids, the lay eggs will be there, and our composter doesn't reach high temperatures to kill these little eggs of the aphids.
So they might even overwinter.
And they come back to the garden.
You add some lovely soil to your garden, and all of a sudden, boom.
Yep. Yeah. So we don't do that. So
and the seeds are an issue too, because of course, same thing. If they're there, they're gonna. You put the soil back in, and all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of plants you weren't planning on.
Correct. So what happened to this time was we had volunteer tomatoes.
Yeah.
So somehow some tomatoes ended up in the compost. We harvest the compost. We add to the garden bed, and there we go, some volunteer tomato plants growing. Right. So the way that we compost in here is it doesn't get too hot. Therefore, the eggs of insects and diseases, and then the egg seeds or weeds and other plants, they just don't die. That's happening in our garden, so time to start being a good janitor, removing, tidying up, cleaning, adding a bit more compost, and continue planting. We still have until September to start continue seeding, and then, once September arrives, we start in winter mode.
Right. So you're talking about adding compost. With the style of gardening you do, do you also or not use fertilizers?
Well, we don't use chemical fertilizers or synthetic fertilizer. We use compost, and if we have some organic matter, like you can buy cheap waste bagged, so we can buy that and add to our garden.
Right.
But mostly we just use compost. We can go to a garden center where we have a veggie mix or a soil amender, which is very well rotting manure, compost, mushroom manure, all mixed together.
Yeah.
And we can buy that and as well add it. So we don't use any synthetic fertilizer.
Right. Good. So what else is happening in the garden?
What else? Oh, the deer.
We've had a bit of a dry spell.
Yes. So if you are familiar with this, a few campus here in Burnaby Mountain, you will see that all the green areas are slowly turning brown. And we have resident deer walking around.
Because we're surrounded by a nice little forest.
Forest, yes. But they find that the sweet grass from their favorite spot is gone.
Yeah.
They came to the garden and they raided it. So now today in the morning arrived and all the tomato plants, the leaves are stripped, just sticks. The same with the beans, the peas, the Swiss chard, and the beets. All leaves are gone. And onions, they are not interested in onions. Surprisingly, the onions are staying there, but the rest is all gone. Neither from the corn. We have corn as well. The corn is standing well, but the rest, is they decide to eat it. That's normal because, around everything is dry, and we have our beautiful garden green. We water frequently, so why not?
So when that happens, do you just have to pull those plants out and put something else in, or can they recover? I guess it depends how badly they've been chopped.
At this moment, with tomato plants, is kind of done.
Yeah.
Because we are midsummer, so at the moment, starting for getting another plant will be a bit expensive if you can't find it.
Yeah.
So it kind of is done. With the beans, we just remove the plant and we can plant a second crop of beans.
Right.
Yeah. With the peas, as I mentioned, they are already dying and being affected by white powdery mildew, so we just harvest it and we can plant something else. Yeah. And with the beets, they are all nice, ready to harvest. So, it was time to harvest.
So, Chris, the deer, they eat off all the greenery, but you can stick still down and get the vegetable itself.
Yeah, the root itself for the beets, yes. Yeah. And with Swiss chard, they will mount it back, so it's no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so the most important is tomatoes. Everybody grows tomatoes over the summer because you want to have a beautiful tomato, but the deer shows up and eats all the leaves, and then you are just with a sticks. No leaves, no food for the plant, so the plant's kind of starving until some new leaves show up, and that it sets back usually at least 2 weeks back until the plant can make new leaves. So just after, what I always advise, just remove the plant and plant something else. Usually, because our space is small, so we try to optimize the space as much as we can. And yeah, this year is no tomato, so that is gardening.
Yeah. So many things to deal with, the pests, the deer, the dry spells, the rainy spells.
The raining spells, yeah. So no raining, although I have seen the forecast in the coming week is going to be kind of rainy, but... the weather is so nice. We are, again, yesterday was so hot in the afternoon. So these days have been very, very hot in the afternoon, which I'm used to be in the sun. But, yeah, yesterday I decided not to go out. My body is telling me, stay indoors. It's too hot. 3 o'clock in the afternoon is too hot to be in the garden. So we have to, well, I'm doing now is being early in the morning.
Yeah.
So 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock
before the heat garden,
and before the heat. So by 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, everything's done, and then we just stay indoors. So nowadays, as you're gardening as well, you will start learning how your body react to the heat. Mm-hmm. One thing is to have a heat stroke, which is your body will go all dizzy and you feel fainting and your stomach is churning. On the other, you have the heat exhaustion, like your head kind of headache, you don't want to do, you have pain in your joints. It's very strange, so two different things. But both of them are serious. So drink lots of water and keep cool.
And if you've been looking after your garden, watering regularly, your garden's going to be pretty resilient, more than you are if you're starting to feel that way. Don't push yourself, I got to get this done. It's like, if you feel it.
Yeah, if you feel like, if you're wearing shorts, you will feel your legs burning. You feel the sun on your legs, your arms as well. Just it's time to stop and be indoors and, prevent to have get sick. Because the season is still going. So we don't want to go down with heat stroke or heat exhaustion and still thinking, I have to do the other thing. So just be drink a lot of water and stay in the shade when this gets too hot.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. Some great advice for our midsummer gardening. Thanks for joining us today, Pablo.
It was a pleasure to be here today.
And how do people find out more about Embark?
So Embark Sustainability is a non-profit organization that is based here in the Student Union building in Burnaby Mountain Campus. We have lots of activities. We focus on food justice and climate equity. And you might know about Embark through our food rescue program that we host every Thursday between 1 and 3 o'clock in the Sideway Hall, and as well through the gardening cohorts that we carry over the year. So at the moment, last week, we started the second summer cohort.
Yep.
So we are meeting with the students for the next six weeks, sharing gardening tips, gardening skills, and maintaining the garden for the summer. Then we have other community kitchen that is coming at the end of the month.
Yep.
We have another community kitchen, which everyone is invited and to join us after 5 o'clock. And then some workshops will come. So if you're very much interested in what's happening with us, we are very active during this summer and fall, please visit our website at embarsustainability.org or follow our social media channels at embarsustainability.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up in about a little over 10 minutes is Democracy Now! And then tomorrow on... Speak Up. Danny will be live in the studio with Autumn Jean Cairns and Ivan Jankovic to talk about their upcoming event, Disorder 11, a queer variety arts showcase taking place on July 31st at the venue Co-op. So tune in tomorrow at 10 a.m. for Tuesday's Speak Up with Danny to hear all about that. Democracy Now! Up in 10 minutes. And now we're going to talk about The Odyssey. Of course, Christopher Nolan has just released a blockbuster film retelling of The Odyssey, featuring a whole host of Hollywood big names.
Which they had a section on Democracy Now! Saying that it was made under exploitive situations in Morocco.
Interesting.
So that's one reason not to see it. I'm going to put it...
And you're going to tell us more reasons not to see it.
Well, I'm going to put it in context.
Okay.
One of the things is that... what I have here... Sometimes I take books out of the library, I just see it. And this is a book that's called Timelines, the events that shaped history. It's mainly a bunch of charts. It starts at 10 million... years ago, because that's when we started becoming humans. And one thing that kind of threw me is that we have here 750 BC. Greek poet Homer composes the Iliad and the Odyssey. And then we got something, 1776 BC, the earliest recorded Olympic Games held in honor of Zeus take place. That's previous to Homer being alive, creating the both of them, the Iliad and the Odyssey. The other thing is that I heard a podcast over the weekend, which is about Zeus, because there's a podcast about Greek culture in general. So I heard the one on Zeus. Now, the concept of Zeus existed prior to Homer.
Right, the gods go back further.
Well, Zeus is the god. Now, what's actually interesting is there's a person called Hesiod. Mm-hmm. He came after Homer. And this is the ones that, you know, he talks about Mother Earth. It's based on the fact that the Earth is flat, by the way, because Mother Earth is the Earth, and everything stems forth from that. Now, what's interesting about that, that was done after Homer, and it's sort of like an actual prequel, I guess, because it's sort of talking about how everything came into existence.
Right.
However,
but is that part of the general mythology of the Greek gods? Because almost all cultures will have an origin story of how the world started.
But what makes it a bit complicated, I think they already had inklings of these concepts previous to Homer.
Right.
So it's sort of a bit confusing a little bit. Now then, the other thing about it is that there was a this was previous to all this.
Yeah.
Thriving on the Greek island of Crete from about 3000 BC to 1450 BC. Was actually kind of a thriving trading situation that collapsed. There was a catastrophic event known as the Late Bronze Age Collapse, wiped out nearly major powers in the Eastern Mediterranean. That was at 1200 BC. And a lot of...
that's an incident they often talk about the Sea Peoples, because... There's all the cultures around that end of the Mediterranean, which Crete was one of them, and over like in the Levant, like where Lebanon and Israel are now. But, you know, and they all sort of collapsed around the same time. And it's not well understood exactly why that is.
Now, this is previous to what's called Western civilization.
Yeah.
The ancient Greeks, after this, situation had happened. That's considered a Western civilization. Mm-hmm. Now, I put a question. I'm just going to put it here. I already did, because I got other stuff. Was Homer the beginning of Western civilization? the beginning. Because I asked the Google, I said, was the belief in Zeus the beginning of Western civilization? They said, no. Was the first Olympic Games the beginning of Western civilization? They went, no. But since I got so many other things in my little thing, Western, okay.
Yeah. So?
Okay, here's one. It says, Homer is not the very beginning of Western civilization, but there was one that sort of was more enthusiastic. It said that it was, which is, but it's sort of so that, so it's sort of, some cases they say that he was or he wasn't, that it's kind of evolved. Now, however, there was something that was created in 1952.
I'm dying to know what you think is the beginning of Western civilization.
These things, it's sort of a bugaboo term, isn't it? I mean, it's like... In fact, you know, the person that taught Bill Clinton at Georgetown University,
yeah.
His contention, which I think is false, he says, Western civilization didn't start until the very term Western civilization was created around the Renaissance, I guess. And that's sort of a bit silly. It's a retroactive concept.
Well, it always is, because, of course, but, you know, even on some level, the idea, you know, the Greek as being the starting point of Western civilization, or however you want to describe it, is sort of, again, an idea that partly formed by a very strong looking back at Greek culture,
right?
Ancient Greek culture and an obsession with, the ancient Greece within the academics in the West and people in the West. Did you know? Sorry, I'm just going to say this quick fact that the Greeks, they used to call themselves their term for themselves was Romans throughout the Ottoman occupation, and they didn't really start calling themselves Greeks until all the Western European academics and the great interest in Greek culture focused so much attention on that period of time and its heritage that around that time, which is in the 17th and 18th century, is when they started calling themselves Greeks instead of referring to themselves as Romans, because they were part of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire.
That's a rather confusing fact, because the ancient Greeks were taken over by the Romans.
Yeah, but then they became part of the Roman Empire,
yeah.
And the Byzantine Empire was effectively a continuation of the Roman Empire, even though the Western Empire disappeared in the West, and they identified as Romans, even though the culture of the Byzantine Empire was empire was in fact Greek. Anyway, you're going to tell us why. What was wrong with the movie, and why people shouldn't go.
In 1952, Britannica Encyclopedia did the Great Books of the Western World.
Yeah,
and that's just they did a revision of it in 1990. But I'm going to stick to the 1952 variation.
Okay.
So it begins with the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
So that's when they start this, and it ends with Freud, of all things. I'm going with the 1952 one, because what's sort of interesting is that they got Karl Marx. This is the height of McCarthyism. They include Karl Marx in it. They got I think Adam Smith and so on. And it ends with Freud, who did one of the worst theater critic.
We got 1 minute to wrap this up.
Okay, it's wrapped up. I think we got. Anyway, don't see the movie.
Do you think people shouldn't see the movie?
Because it's a silly thing. I mean, Plato and Aristotle's a bit more of a lasting impact. Maybe the commies are Aristophanes or something. I mean, anyway, so there was some more I could have said, but anyway, I just don't see it. It was done on our exploitation, and it's probably going to be pretty boring. I don't know. You think it's going to be exciting? It's just, I mean, you have to believe in it. If you believe in it, who believes in this anymore? No one.
Well, it's just storytelling.
Have you seen this movie already?
I have not seen the movie already. It only came out this weekend, and probably busy in the theaters. But I will go see it.
Oh, really?
I probably will go. I would like.
We're going to have to call Amy Goodman. What conference?
You're going to tell on me?
Amy Goodman, you can't, anyway. I don't agree with everything with Amy Goodman.
Okay. Well, Amy Goodman is coming up in about 15 seconds on Democracy Now! And maybe she'll have more to say about the Odyssey as well, but probably a whole lot about Trump and everything he's doing to destroy the United States. Democracy Now! Is coming up right about now. Stay tuned for a lot more great programming here on